with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Pavan. Welcome to the 67th episode of Robots. In this show, we'll be talking about science fiction with world-renowned author Greg Bear.
We'll then be telling you about our initiative to gather a maximum number of YouTube videos of robots celebrating the holiday season. But first, as always, let's listen to the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Ryuma Niyama, currently a postdoc at MIT's Robot Locomotion Group, has built an anthropomorphic running robot. The robot's two legs are modeled after human legs, with each of the six major thigh muscles replaced by a set of pneumatic actuators. The robot's lower legs are carbon blades, similar to the prosthetic feet used by South African Paralympic runner Oscar Pistorius. The running robot's hardware was developed as part of Niyama's PhD at the Department of Mechanoinformatics at the University of Tokyo, with Satoshi Nishikawa and Yasuo Kuniyoshi. At MIT, Niyama is now working on teaching the robot how to run by copying the timing and pattern of human muscle movement. In a first video, the robot performs a short five-step dash, reaching 1.2 meters per second before falling over. The researchers are now fine-tuning the robot's feedback control system and working towards tests on a real running track. In other news, New Zealand robot band The Trons has released a new music video. The band, which consists entirely of robots and has no human members, has been going for 3 years and has played over 80 live gigs. The robots are built mainly from junk and salvaged electronics centered around a 15-year-old computer from a decommissioned vending machine. The robot's junky nature also has the welcome side effect of adding some mechanical randomness to an otherwise robotic performance. For a video of the anthropomorphic running robot's first dash, or to request a gig from the Trons for your Christmas or New Year's celebration, have a look at the robot's forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Greg Bear is a famous writer, author of more than 30 books of science fiction and fantasy. Over the years, he's been awarded 2 Hugos and 5 Nebulas for his fiction and has been called the best working writer of hard science fiction by the Ultimate Encyclopedia of Science Fiction. His expertise in science has gotten him writing about topics from evolution to robotics. He's also an expert in Asimov's rules, thanks to the sequel he wrote for the Foundation series. Finally, Bear will be telling us about his vision of the world and how his talent in bringing pieces together within one story has gotten him helping the U.S. Army, the CIA, and Homeland Security.
Hi, Greg. Welcome to Robots.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Well, I'm a science fiction writer. My name is Greg Bear. I've been writing science fiction for over 50 years now. I've been published for 45 of those years. I've written 30 novels, roughly. I haven't actually counted recently. And I've got, a lot of roots in the science community as well as the science fiction community. Fortunately, I've had a lot of scientists help me out over the years with my books.
That's really huge, and you're one of the best-known science fiction writers of this era. Why did you choose science fiction?
When I was a kid, I made that choice, actually. It was the most exciting area. I read everything. I read a lot of different things, and science fiction, both in films and television and comics, but also in books. By the time I was 9 or 10, I was reading a lot of science fiction books. All of these things impressed me with the notion that science fiction was where I wanted to be.
And what would you say is your style, your writing style?
Actually, it kind of varies depending on the book. I don't have a particular personal style other than, my choice of subject matter. But what I do is each time I write a book, I kind of adapt my style a little bit to the characters and to the subject of the book.
Would you say you're a more positive person or negative? Or
when I write my stories, I write them as if they are realistic novels set in the present day. So what I'm doing is I'm describing a world that is neither negative nor positive, but just live. Something that you know, you might experience in your everyday life, but moved over into a future world or a near future world to another planet. I try to make my books seem as concrete and as variable and as enigmatic as everyday life is.
So here at Robots, you really love talking about robots and robots in science fiction. Do you have any favorite characters throughout science fiction in general?
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite robots, of course, is R. Daniil Oliva. When I was a kid, I read Caves of Steel and the Asimov robot stories, and I thought that Oliva was just fabulous. And so when I had a chance to work in the Foundation universe, I wanted to use him as a character. You know, basically the oldest living intelligence of his time is a robot, and he's a humanoid robot. What's that going to be like? I thought it was a very interesting exercise.
Can you maybe give us an overview of all the robots that you've personally worked on and those you've created?
I've actually worked less with robots than with artificial intelligences. In Queen of Angels and Slant, I created a character named Jill, who actually, her precursors first appear in Quantico and Mariposa, the near future thrillers. So Jill, my artificial intelligence, is being created at Mind Design in Quantico in an early version at the end of Mariposa also. Jill acquires self-conscious awareness in Queen of Angels through a series of traumatic events where she's forced to engage in a feedback loop of realizing that she has or it has a particular presence in the world, a social relationship to the humans around her, and that creates the feedback loop that gives her self-awareness. Also the fact that she's being mistreated, she feels. The notion of when robots would become self-aware has always been interesting to me. And so over the years, I've worked up a theory of what our own human self-awareness actually is. And it's deeply connected with being a social animal, for one thing. We are modeling our behavior with other social animals, and that model becomes an image in our head, which then gets fixed as a kind of a circle in which we keep perceiving ourselves and trying to predict how we'll react to stimuli. And that becomes the social version of self-awareness. So when robots acquire that, they will know they're fully human, and then they could gripe and bitch at us all they want.
So you would say that self-awareness is sort of the condition to become human?
I think there's a basic consciousness that's there, but self-awareness, as we typically describe it, is in fact, I think, a social function. Yeah, so I believe that animals such as rats and so on and have to engage in complex social behaviors might also have a version of self-awareness, if only because they need to figure out how they're going to be reacted to by their fellows in the society.
That's really interesting. If it's a matter of circuitry, then we could sort of say that we're the robots.
We are. You know, I think that anything that we try to create artificially, we have to model on the wisdom of nature. And if we look at ourselves and figure out how we function, then we have a better idea of how robots might function. That's the first step. The next step, of course, if you really want to get radical, is you try and improve upon that. And that's probably where we'll make some huge mistakes.
So the reason for creating a self-aware robot, is that really to try to understand something about the human condition? So to use the robot as a sort of image of the human?
Yeah, a mirror. We've always, you know, created simulacra and so on as kind of mirror images of ourselves. We're trying to understand who we are. And I'm sure that quest is true with the robot. It's also true when we create or write about alien beings. It's really difficult to write about the truly alien because we've never met them, other than other human beings who can be quite alien from certain perspectives. So when we create alien beings in fiction or in films or whatever, we're trying to mirror some aspect of our own personality and expand upon it, usually a small aspect. So this alien is particularly carnivorous, or this alien is particularly brainy, or this alien is cold and you know, so-called inhuman. All of those functions, including being inhuman, we have found in being human.
You mentioned before that you wrote one of the sequels to Isaac Asimov's Foundation series. Why were you interested in the Foundation series?
Well, of course, it's one of the key works of science fiction. I read it when I was young. I loved it. And when the Asimov estate allowed Gregory Benford and David Brin and myself to craft a new Foundation trilogy, it was pretty hard to pass by. I'd already written in the Star Trek universe. I was a fan of Star Trek. I realized later on, as I was writing in the Star Wars universe, that Asimov's Foundation universe is so huge that it could actually encompass nearly all the other science fiction artificial worlds, like Dune or Star Wars. These could all be, you know, incidents occurring in corners of Asimov's universe. He has a quadrillion human beings in Foundation. And whether he was just playing with numbers or not, I don't know, but that's a very big number.
With it being so huge, how do you actually approach such a project? You have to learn about this world.
Well, we learned from Isaac, because what Isaac did was he told you about a galactic empire through the dialogue and discussions of several people in a small room. Basically, it's a narrative. You have individual characters telling their stories. They give you an insight, kind of a porthole view of how the rest of the Foundation world operates. He doesn't actually give you the Cinerama view, except on occasional scenes. When Benford and Bryn and I worked on this, I focused on the first week of the Foundation's first novel, first story, and wrote my story in that first week. So you have this huge perspective, but it's a very narrow window that we're looking at it through.
Is there anything you would have done differently than Asimov?
You know, I actually found myself almost channeling Isaac when I was writing the book, because his approach was so very successful getting through to readers, even many readers who weren't familiar with science fiction. So I didn't want to do things differently. I just wanted to act as if Isaac had opportunities to take his own vision and move it forward. And in a sense, it's a collaborative process, even though Isaac was unable to speak to me directly. I really felt his presence as I was writing the book.
I read an interview of you where you were saying you sort of figured out some of the key elements Asimov uses to make his story so successful. And you said you couldn't give them the secret. Can you give us maybe some ideas?
Well, Isaac's secret was Trantor's New York City. You know, this great artificial planet covered with aluminum and everything is New York City. Isaac was a claustrophiliac. That is, he liked to stay indoors and write more than anything. The only thing that would bring him out into the cold and the rain was the temptation of, say, a corned beef sandwich or a good meal or company or occasionally, you know, short trips to Boston or whatever. He didn't like to travel very far at all. And that was the attitude of the people on Trantor. And even the people in Caves of Steel, as they are basically sequestered. One of the worst experiences in, I think it's, oh, I forget which of the Foundation books it was, Foundation and Earth possibly, Harry Seldon is caught outside in the rain. And that's very traumatic for him. And I imagine it was traumatic for Isaac. The other clue you get is that Isaac is giving us renaming of New York City places and so on for parts of Trantor. It's kind of hard to break the code, but what I did was I realized that if you're going to have a prison on Trantor, then you might call it the Rikerian prison, because in New York you have Rikers Island. So it creates a subconscious resonance of gosh, that sounds vaguely familiar. Have I been there? And in a way, we have. If we've been to New York City or any major metropolitan area, then we've kind of experienced what Harry Seldon went through on Trantor.
So the future is really just a version of today.
We all do that in different ways. We take our personal experiences and we distort them, we expand upon them, we idealize them, or we negativize them, and we put them into our fiction.
On our show, we love to talk about Asimov's rules, and I wanted to know if you think they have any special strengths or weaknesses.
I like the first three rules. What I was pointing out in Foundation and Chaos is as soon as you get to the zeroth rule, then you've created everything that happens in human society and history. This notion that if you do something for the greater good, you can get away with anything, that really leads to the problems we face today, because, of course, who's to determine what the greatest good was or is? And so when our Daniil Olivaw is involved with the zeroth rule, that's when he becomes fully human and fully capable of making big errors.
Okay, let's think hypothetically, because a lot of people are thinking about these rules actually to implement them in real robots today to make sure that we're, you know, making robots that make good decisions and such. Do you think that a version of these rules would be suitable for real robots?
The first three rules are suitable for robots that are tools that we want to, you know, maintain as servants. So if you have a Roomba in your house, for example, you don't want it to deliberately run over your toe. But if it believes it's too dangerous outside, for example, there's a lot of snow and ice outside right now, and my Roomba prevents me from going outside, that leads to a problem. And that actually was addressed before Isaac by Jack Williamson in a story called With Folded Hands, where robots are our caretakers. And so they don't let us have any freedom because we might hurt ourselves. If robots have that kind of power over us, do not allow a human being to come to harm under any circumstances, that could be bad. So we have to be very careful about, A, the roles we assign to robots, B, the rules with which they enact those roles, and our ability to maintain freedom under those circumstances.
With respect to the zeroth law, so what you were saying is basically that the zeroth law is like having no law, right?
No, the zeroth law is the function of actual ordinary human society and history. You sometimes have to, as they say, break a few eggs to make omelets. Well, that can let you do a lot of things if you carry it to extremes, and that's how history operates. In the flow of history, in the flow of organizing society, of trying to acquire resources for your tribe, your group, your nation, you can do awful things. And sometimes those awful things are utterly terrible and they don't accomplish the ends you set out to do. You failed miserably. You've killed, millions of people. So what was your whole point? Well, if we allow robots to make those decisions, then they've become, in a sense, our humans. But if they live longer than us and have more power than us, then they definitely become our masters, and probably not very good masters. The one thing about intelligence is it's designed to solve problems with inadequate information. A computer can only solve problems if all the variables are there. But living beings never have all the variables in place. And so we make our decisions based upon algorithms or neural net decisions that are incapable. When we're incapable of gathering all the information, we're more efficient at survival than a system like a computer that basically freezes up if the variables aren't there. That problem is that sometimes we move ahead not only with inadequate information, but with wrong information or with bad programming, bad social skills, a bad view of how history works, or a negative view of other people outside of our tribe. And those things lead to the nightmare of history from which we are always trying to awaken.
But if AI has better information, can we suppose that they might actually make better choices?
AIs, artificial intelligences, may or may not have better information than we do. They may be programmed to be less tribal, in which case they won't support, our particular political party or our nation or whatever, and then we shut them off. We're very, very demanding as a species. If we have servants, if the robots are our servants, do we want them in a consulting role? Do we want them to be like Gort, who actually has the power of life and death if we screw up? Do we want robot police from the stars that can wipe out entire populations if we don't behave? It's all big questions. I think the answer is basically, no, I'd rather be on my own, thank you. And then let the robots clean up the floors and do the dirty work and maybe, do calculations for us, but not run our lives.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Generally, how do you see the cross-fertilization between scientists and science fiction writers?
Well, it's great fun. In a sense, science fiction is the dreaming mind of science. We've seen scientists write science fiction often in the past, but we've also seen scientists and science fiction writers get together and hoist a beer and talk about things and theorize, and then the scientists quite often are very amused and sometimes even pleased when their ideas end up in a science fiction story. It's no mistake that in Terminator 2, the name of the scientist that creates Skynet is Dyson. Dyson seems to be, based on Freeman Dyson, and this is a great name for a scientist. So he becomes a science fiction character. That kind of interplay, or when I was writing Darwin's Radio, the interplay of getting together with virologists and evolutionary biologists and microbiologists and talking shop, I love that. I love the ability to sit down and ask key questions and even suggest alternate ideas, alternate theories. And by the time I finished Darwin's Radio, I'd had contact with a lot of scientists, and after the book came out, it was reviewed in Nature, of all places, more of a scientific review than a novel review. They were discussing the ideas and how probable they were. And I still get email from people. If you go to my website, you'll see an email from one of the world's experts on pheromones talking about, 11 years after the take of Darwin's Radio, in biology and how successful or unsuccessful it might be. So that interplay is common in science fiction. You have, of course, writers like Brin and Benford and Slonczewski and earlier Robert Forward, many science fiction writers who were, in fact, scientists and kind of use the dreaming mind of science to inform their fiction, but also to get their ideas out there. Robert Forward was one of the most forward-thinking people, literally, in space propulsion, black hole drives, gravitation. He actually invented a gravity meter and patented it, and it's still in use today. We've got a lot of people who are on the periphery of science. Murray Leinster, for example, a well-known writer from the 1930s through the 1970s, wrote under the name Murray Leinster. His name was Will F. Jenkins. He invented things like the rear projection screens that were used in movies like 2001. He invented the material, which 3M then developed and patented. So that's there's a lot of inventors in our field. There's just a lot of philosophical thinking and scientific thinking that goes into science fiction that seems compatible with what scientists do also.
So speaking of Darwin's radio, I read an article saying that you actually predicted that human endogenous retroviruses are involved in human speciation. Did you ever want to be a scientist instead of being a sci-fi writer?
I did want to be an astronomer when I was in college, but I flunked calculus, and so that put an end to that. I like to think scientifically. I even like to think mathematically, but I'm probably not capable of doing the math. Now, that doesn't preclude my being a scientist, but actually I'm more of a storyteller than, if I were to be involved in science, I would have to try out different things, difficult things like putting together lab experiments and creating equipment and so on. That would be great fun, but I think I'm probably better as a storyteller. So I'll let the scientists do the hard work, but along the way, I love to talk with them and kind of engage in half humorous course corrections and suggestions and so on. That's a lot of fun for me.
You're very good at figuring out what the next big thing will be. I learned that you talked about nanotechnology and such in your books. How do you catch on?
Hard to say. Basically, by reading the journals, I actually got the idea for blood music from an article on biochips that was published in New Scientist in 1982. I read that article and suddenly everything seemed to click into place. I'd long been trying to figure out how evolution worked, how biological systems worked, and I've been reading Arthur Koestler over the years, and of course, experts in evolutionary theory from Darwin on, and I was trying to think out why the current version of evolutionary theory was incomplete, this notion that only random change was allowed. I didn't think that made any sense. After I started reading the article on biochips, I asked myself, well, isn't DNA a kind of a computational system? Doesn't it have to have, programming measures and stops and loops and all that sort of stuff? And so I used that as the basis of the idea of reprogramming DNA to be actually, a neural network. Turns out that DNA is a kind of a neural network, and so is the interactions between DNA and cells through sexuality, but also through swapping genes. Bacteria do that, viruses do that. The whole genome is an ecosystem, and an ecosystem then becomes a neural network where everything is interacting, and you have communications through pheromones, through exchange genes, through viruses. All these different measures are methods of communicating between nodes in a neural network. And that makes the problem of deciding how biology works and how living things work immensely more interesting and much, much more complicated. Because we can design computers, we design them through mathematics. Computers operate purely in mathematical realms. Biology does not. Biology has systems that can be mathematical, and we can use mathematics to describe aspects of those systems. But the overall view of living things is not, I think, mathematically tractable. I believe we must move beyond pure mathematics to understand how living things work. So all of that comes out of just an insight way back in 1982 that led me down the path, a self-correcting path, because I realized later on that the notion of computational DNA was not complete.
As a science fiction writer, your job is really to imagine the future, and this is often seen as being a sort of oracle, and as such you've actually been hired by the U.S. Army or the CIA to think about scenarios concerning, for example, terrorist threats and such. How do you go about thinking about these things? Is it like writing a book?
Some of it is like writing a book. Again, it's a chance to get together with the people who actually have to solve real difficult problems and seeing how they operate and thinking, trying to think as they think and help them out. I wasn't alone in this. A number of writers were called in, including screenwriters, after 2001, to help the government figure out where it wasn't thinking of threats, how the ideas it was missing, the things that it wasn't following through on. And there were a number of those conferences, and then that led to working with Homeland Security. Some of the Science and Technology Division of Homeland Security, people would invite us to come out and talk with them in Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. And a group of us, part of the Sigma group, did that, and that was very interesting. What I like to do is I like to see the human element of these massive problem-solving operations so that I can get a sense of not only where the technological ideas may be, but where the social ideas may be. The interaction between the two, of course, is where programs are implemented. And so I wasn't so much prognosticating or predicting the future as helping these people figure out areas in which they weren't thinking ahead too much. And I found that they were actually very good at what they did. And so a number of us, for example, Jerry Pornell or Larry Niven or Arlen Andrews, could come up with scenarios based on their experience in government that didn't so much prognosticate as help them help Homeland Security officials figure out where they weren't thinking in ways that had been handled in the past. Jerry's experience in government and in defense industry material back in the 1950s was very useful in trying to predict how programs could go through Congress today or that sort of thing. So it wasn't so much a technological thing, although that was definitely there. We had a lot of fun discussing different technological aspects of their ideas. But it was also a social implementation program. People with experience in the past helping out people who are working and doing the hard work today. And what must be understood is that we never made policy decisions or recommendations. We were there purely to facilitate thinking in these areas. And whether or not they listened to us is something we may never know. It wasn't our purview to be listened to. We were just there to stimulate discussion.
So really a way to make the scenarios, to take the pieces and put it all together.
Yeah, we help them put their models together.
How do you see the real world develop in the next 50 years?
I think it's going to be kind of herky-jerky as usual. Back in the 1960s, I kind of thought things were going to be straight line. We were actually going to head towards the future envisioned in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Space exploration would head forward. All that sort of stuff would happen. Well, I was wrong, and so, we were all too optimistic. And also it turned out that in terms of predicting the future, we were leaving out some major problems. We were idealizing things. Space travel, for example, we were leaving out the whole problem of biology and space medicine. A lot of research was being done, but it turned out to be incredibly difficult to keep people healthy in zero gravity for very long periods of time. So right now in space flight, we're doing incremental steps. We're doing industrial steps. We're building new kinds of spacecraft and private industry and so on. There's a change over there. But that straight line development of spending more and more and more on spaceflight never really happened. And so when we think about the future, we have to realize that we don't have all the facts available to us right now. We certainly don't know what the future weather will be like in terms of social interactions and changes and histories. And also we're dragged back by the past. One of the things we're dealing with now is 13th century culture. It's still with us. It haunts us in many different ways. In the United States, we're haunted right now by some of the aftershock of the Civil War, of all things. We're still, American conservatism is kind of nibbling over the wounds and resentments of things that happened 150 years ago. So we are a very conservative species. We take things incrementally, and sometimes we pull back before we take the next leap, and I think that's what's happening now. I really don't know where we'll be in 50 years. I hope we will be a little more organized and a little less fractious than we are now, but no guarantees.
What would you like to see as future culture?
I'd like to see a culture where people are more integrated, where we realize the role of society and government and individual responsibilities a little more clearly. In the United States, I'd like to see a more rational approach to world politics. I've been fighting against this trend towards conservative radicalization for 30 years now, not very successfully. I think we're worse off than we've ever been. I feel that where we need to be in the future is more, in a sense, like where Europe is now. But there's a caveat with that. Europe is beautiful. It's lovely. It's more organized. The transit systems are better. But in the United States, the political ferment is hot and heavy. It's just amazing to watch the range of ideas going around here. And sometimes we behave very, very stupidly. But in that background, as we're behaving stupidly, there's change coming. And so, in a sense, the United States is still, as a young country, kind of behaving like a teenager. We don't know what we'll be doing next. We're not in control of our emotions, and yet there's incredible potential here. So how that will continue, I don't know. We've also got, of course, the young nations of China and India, young nations that are far older in their mythic background and their history than the United States, and yet, as democracies, they're quite young. And the ferment going on in India and China is astonishing to watch. Right now, we have science fiction communities building up in India and China that remind me of the United States science fiction communities in the 1950s. They are forward-thinking. They are wonderfully young in their outlook, and they are fresh. And that reminds me of the ferment that we had 40 years ago in the United States. Where this will go, I don't know, but it's very encouraging.
Maybe we can wrap up by your latest book, Hull 03. Tell us a bit about the plot.
Well, Hull 03 is based on a classic notion of the generation starship. But when I was taking science classes in the 1960s, one of my astronomy professors pointed out that to get close to the speed of light, the equations of rocket propulsion told you that you needed a horrendous amount of reaction mass to even begin to approach that velocity, something on the order of, maybe a billion or a trillion times more than the mass of your delivered starship. And that intrigued me. I thought, okay, that's true in some respects. You know, the Enterprise is going to have to carry around this huge yolk sack of reaction mass to get up to speed, unless barring, of course, warp technology or whatever. But even an impulse engine getting you to, 75% of the speed of light is going to require a great deal of reaction mass. Where are we going to get that? So after years of waving my hands and using various high-tech propulsion systems in books like Anvil of Stars, I decided, okay, let's sit down and figure this out. Where is the best source of large supplies of reaction mass? Well, comets, small moons, that sort of thing. The Oort cloud, outside of our solar system, on the outskirts of our solar system. There's things as big as Pluto out there wandering around, and they're mostly ice. So I figured, okay, what we'll do is we'll take and strap a starship to one of those and take it off to the stars. But, of course, things are going to go wrong. So my character wakes up, my main character, Teacher, wakes up from a beautiful dream of this totally rational, lovely, successful starship operation into a nightmare of cold and misery and pain and horror, realizing that, yes, the ship was constructed, but things didn't turn out as they expected, and as a part of the ship, he's been programmed to have a certain background, a certain dream state, belief in his origins, which is not real. So he has to rediscover his life completely in a ship that's gone quite haywire. And that whole combination of kind of a Philip K. Dick, Gene Wolfe psychology with a Roger Zelazny style of delivery, the story, it was just wonderful fun for me to write. And I think it's doing well here, getting good response. But it's also a return to space. It's a return to the notion of how could you actually build a starship? How would it work? How much would it cost? How much expenditure of social funds? And, if you can only build a few of these and your whole society is depending on them, then what kind of systems would you build into that ship that could go wrong?
You actually have a beautiful video trailer for this book on YouTube. Is that a way of getting people in front of their screens back into books?
I think so, yeah. This was put together by my publishers at Orbit, and they used some game engines and created this this lovely experience, which is kind of an introduction to what might be happening to you if you're on the starship in Hull 03. But it's also connected to this notion. I'm working on the Halo universe now. I've been privileged to work with the people at 343 and Microsoft on creating the mythology and the history of the Forerunners, who are the species that actually built the Halos 100,000 years ago and manipulated human history. So the first volume in that set, that trilogy, Forerunner Cryptum, will be out in January 4th, and I'm writing the second one now. And that's classic science fiction. It takes us back to human origins, to huge constructs, to ring worlds, and to alien invasions and the flood and all of that stuff. And so in a sense, I'm communicating with the gaming community through those novels as well. And my son is a great gamer. I've enjoyed playing games on the computer and on the television, and that's a whole new way of telling stories. And to be able to play on that playground with really great creators like the Halo community is fascinating for me. Also, I'm working on a new way of delivering fiction in the Mongoliad. This is at www.mongoliad.com. You can check us out. Working with Neil Stevenson and a great group of writers to put together a historical novel that's delivered to your Kindle, to your iPhone, your iPad on a serial basis. Subscription is $10 a year. It's a great bargain. And we're spinning this novel out week by week, kind of like a television series. That's another interesting way of talking about fiction.
So, Greg, is there anything else in the pipeline?
Well, Quantico, the sequel to Quantico, Mariposa, was published last year in hardcover, and this month it's out in paperback, so you can check out the Near Future Thrillers, which incorporates the information and the education I received working with the various government agencies over the years. And that's Mariposa.
Excellent, Greg. Thanks a lot for being here with us on Robots.
My pleasure. Thanks for interviewing me.
We thought we'd give you a glimpse at Greg Beer's work by reading you part of Mariposa that describes the early mind design artificial intelligence called Jones. Turns out that these AIs serve as a basis for other books such as Queen of Angels, Slant, and Moving Mars. Christine, on to you.
Mariposa excerpt by Greg Beer. Back at Mind Design. Deep in the sub-basement, around the corner from the freight elevator, through a door in a half-height wall topped with panes of thick glass, an early version of Jones lay spread out on the concrete floor like an art installation. Oddly patterned and spaced cubes of plastic and steel hooked up with thick fiber optic cables and pipes carrying nutrient fluids. Jones Zero had taken 5 years to build and 2 to charge up. They had learned a lot from simply getting him to turn on and give simple responses to basic neurologic queries, Gödel number key code strings, lifeboat backups, net housekeeping. Like Hal, Jones Zero had learned a birthday diagnostic song, not Daisy, but Sergeant Pepper's. That was how much artificial thinking had advanced in 50 years. Of course, even the later versions of Jones were not real minds, not yet true thinkers, more like idiot savants. But after the launch, it soon became obvious that this was the best pattern recognition tool anyone had yet devised. Jones Zero could not only comprehend any natural language and find matches in even highly degraded databases, but he could deliver highly reliable analytics as to dialect, accent, even birthplace and level of education. He, they always referred to a Jones as if it were human, could tell whether a voice came from a native who had learned the language as a child, or from a highly educated person who had learned it in school, and even the age at which the language training had begun. What was more, Jones could penetrate any false accent and pick up the underlying native tongue. The Quiet Man and the Turing 7 had soon moved Jones Zero up to weather. He had learned quickly. In 6 months, the distributed computer in its liquid-filled boxes made up of borax, glass, and gel-suspended rods of PNA and DNA had quickly proved itself to be a master of winds. Jones 1.0, smaller, faster, better, beat the best automated and human long-range forecasters. the Quiet Man decided that Jones 1.0 could be duplicated and shipped to key positions around the planet, standing in for the next step, Jones 2.0, already in development. Jones 1.0 would act as the trigger for his successor, as an atom bomb is used to trigger a hydrogen bomb. There was to be only one Jones 2.0, and his work was destined to be very important indeed. Supervising the world's first nanosecond-updated worldwide financial data network, collected by over 5,000 mainframes controlling server farms throughout Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. Jones 2.0 was about to become the quiet, humming heart of MS-ARC. Mind Design's connection with Talos Corporation was the biggest secret of all. The Quiet Man kept Jones Zero in the basement of Mind Design as a kind of museum piece. Nathaniel Trace seemed to be alone with the machine in its concrete chamber. He felt almost shy in its quiet presence.
We thought it would be awesome to start a momentum towards making videos about robots for the holiday season. Therefore, if you have a video of your robot saying Merry Christmas, singing jingle bells, bringing presents, going down a chimney, or serving champagne on New Year's, send us the link and we'll feature it on our dedicated YouTube channel and on our website.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
At the Robots Podcast, we wish you a wonderful holiday season. Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Merry Christmas with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.